Good. We're going live.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
Hi, this is Eagle One from Eagle Speak, and on the line with me is, I hope, Rear Admiral Kirby, the Chief of Information for the U.S. Navy. Admiral Kirby, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. How about me?
Oh, I hear you fine. Sorry about the confusion. At the last minute, Sal was running late. I had to take over the board. I'm sure he'll join us shortly. Say, has there been anything interesting in the news involving the Navy recently you'd like to talk about?
Well, look, I mean, there's a lot going on. Obviously, the big news for us over the weekend, of course, was that Secretary Hagel approved the return from furlough for most civilians that work for the Defense Department, and, of course, that includes so many of our civilian shipmates in the Navy, and we're glad to be able to bring them back to work tomorrow.
Well, that is good. How do you get that information? How does that pass down to you from SecDef down through SecNav, I would assume, to your office?
Well, you can imagine there's been a flurry of email activity all weekend as these decisions were getting made, and the Pentagon Press Secretary George Little has done a good job keeping those of us in the public affairs line informed of what Secretary Hagel was up to. We have also been in touch. I've been in touch with Secretary Mabus and with the CNO all weekend as well, so I made sure I had their intentions. And then once we knew we had a decision today, we did our best to get that out through social media, through our website, and through a series of calls and emails to workers as well.
Well, how far down does that go? I mean, are we looking at, like, civilian flight instructors at our basic air training group and stuff like that, or does this involve more the DOD civilians or DON civilians in the Pentagon area?
No, it's across the department, up and down. There's a few exceptions. There's a few groups that won't be allowed to return en masse, legislative affairs folks, many public affairs civilians who work specifically at external outreach activities. Some folks in the CIOs and the chief information offices and in other technological fields. But by and large, the great majority of civilians will be brought back. There's a whole list of exceptions, which we've put on our website, that people can look at to see if they're in those fields, they'll know whether they can be brought back or not. And the other thing that we're doing is we're reaching out by phone and calling those civilians that are not going to be brought back so that they understand that they should stay on furlough and that we'll keep them informed as things go along. But if you don't get a phone call from your manager, you should assume that you are coming back from furlough.
Okay, and what email address should they be checking? I mean, not email,
just go to our
address.
Website, www.navy.mil. We'll have it on there, a statement from me, which we just posted about an hour ago, that makes this very clear and lays out the exempted activities, those that will not be allowed to return from furlough. They're all right there in my statement. And as I've said in my statement too, if anybody has any questions about whether they are or they aren't, they should simply call their manager, and their manager should be able to let them know.
Well, sounds pretty complicated, but at the same time, it sounds like you've simplified it as much as you can.
Well, we're trying. You make a good point. It is going to be complicated, and I think we all need to recognize that Monday and Tuesday are not going to be like normal days. There's going to be people who didn't get the word and end up coming to work when they shouldn't, and there's probably going to be people that aren't going to be coming to work and they should. And one of the things that we're trying to tell people is that it's okay. We'll work through this. The first few days of this week are probably going to be a little bit messy, but we're going to work through this and keep everybody as informed as we can.
When you one of the advertisements that Sal ran for the our discussion today had to do with the kind of the straightening out of the communications mess. So let's take the events at the Navy Yard, tragic events at the Navy Yard, and how much misinformation was put out. And then as I've been watching the unfolding events of this weekend, where it appears at least a couple of our special operations groups, both Army and Navy, have been involved in activities, that information seems to be changeable, shall I say, the best, at least by the news services. How much of your time is spent trying to get a handle on what the quote ground truth is, and helping the media find out what the real story is?
Well, much of my time is spent doing that every single day, no matter what the issue is, especially when you have unfolding operations or events such as the Navy Yard shooting, when things are moving really, really fast, and it's difficult to know what ground truth is. We try to move as quick as we can with the most up-to-date information that we have. And if we're not sure about it, we're pretty good at telling people, look, this is what we think, but you know, either we can't confirm it or we're not 100% on it, and we try to walk reporters away from reporting stuff that we can't confirm 100%. But on the other hand, you've got to try to help them understand context as fast as you can. So it's a constant struggle every single day to do this, but again, particularly with a fast-moving thing. I won't talk about the operations over the weekend. I think you can understand why I wouldn't get into that. But it is also, I think we all need to recognize, and you saw this with the coverage of the Navy Yard shooting, when there is a fast-moving story that is complicated it's difficult to know what's really going on the inside because you don't have access to information right away, it's important to be willing to admit to mistakes and to provide corrected information as quickly as possible. And I'm not just talking about us in public affairs. I'm talking about the media, too. They got things wrong as well in the first hours of that Washington Navy Yard shooting, and some were better than others in terms of constantly updating and making corrections and making it clear that, you know, what they had was preliminary information. I think the public understands that. They understand that not everything is going to be coming out the moment something happens. You just have to be, I think, you have to be extra vigilant and extra transparent and honest with yourselves about what you know and what you don't know.
Eagle One. Eagle One.
Hey, this is John Kirby. I'm still here.
Thank you for your patience with me. I've been having technical difficulties, but I seem to have finally connected. And listening, this is Sal, by the way, my apologies. And listening to your last answer, I guess that's one of the interesting things that we saw this weekend with the raids on Libya and Somalia, kind of comparing it to the reaction that we saw after bin Laden was taken care of, is there's that fine line with a lot of these high-profile events that involve our special forces that they're trying to find the right balance between transparency but also respecting some of the significant security requirements that have to do with special operations. What are some of the lessons that we've learned and that we're probably going to have to keep close to heart as the war we're in evolves about respecting the need for transparency and acknowledging some high-profile actions, but making sure that we keep our special forces details and personnel a little close to the vest?
Yeah, great question. I think the biggest thing you want to do is preserve TTP, right? Tactics, techniques, and procedures. And so sometimes in order to do that, so that the bad guys don't know what we're capable of, you got to even preserve information like identifying the unit or even the type of unit. So I think you got to, you know, these are operations that are conducted with the American people foremost in mind and their safety foremost in mind. And so there's an obligation to inform the American people when something is done on their behalf in this regard. But you want to acknowledge it, which you could see the Pentagon acknowledged it today. But you don't get into the specific tactical details because especially when it's an when you are able to get a terrorist alive and with the intention of trying to derive more intelligence, you certainly don't want to sacrifice your ability to do that by giving away too much information to potential future adversaries or other of that individual's network. So you gotta find that very fine line. You gotta walk that very fine line, and that can be tricky at times, particularly with the speed with which information moves these days, and the fact that even in small villages in the middle of nowhere, people have cell phone cameras, and people can they can still get out there in the Twitter sphere and put information out. So you just have to be careful, and I think it requires some discipline that we are good at, but sometimes we need to be even better at in terms of not just message discipline, but information discipline. And I think I think again, without getting into the details of this weekend's operations, I think you saw that sort of very fine balance achieved.
Eagle One, you there?
I have to press the unmute button before I can talk, right?
I'm the only one allowed to have technical difficulties with Admiral Kirby. You got to make it look good, Eagle One. Okay, over you.
It's only one switch. When we have a major shift like the Pacific pivot and the seeming strategic decisions that go along with it, like the types of ships and stuff that the Navy would be interested in acquiring or continue to pursue, how does that affect what your shop does? Are you guys working closely with CNO and the his speeches about the nature of what we're looking at, or are you kind of out independently working on issues?
No. We're very much linked in with the CNO staff and with the secretary staff as well, and we have a great relationship even with OSD. I mean, there are times when Secretary Hagel will want to talk about the rebalance of the Pacific, and I've got a great relationship with the Pentagon press secretary and with Mr. Hagel's speechwriters. I mean, it's pretty well coordinated, and we all try to stay, pretty much in line with where we actually are going. But it's a coordinated effort, and we're the message hasn't changed even with all the budget uncertainty. We are moving more forces there, but we are also moving more focus there. There's a difference. I mean, we're going to be putting all the newest stuff that we get out into the Pacific. So the first P-8 squadron is going to move out there. The first JSF operational squadron, when it's operational, will be sent to the forward deployed carrier strike group. We are putting more intellectual capacity and energy towards the relationships over there. All those sort of tenets, those pillars of the rebalance, is stuff that we've stayed consistent on, and we intend to stay consistent on, even in the budget uncertainty. So things may get a little slower. We may not get out there as fast as we want, given budget uncertainty. But we're still going to move in that way, and we're still trying to stay very steady with respect to what we're going to put out there, and how we're going to talk about what we're putting out there. It's real important. Consistency in this case is real important to our allies and partners as well. They're watching everything very carefully, especially as we go through this the shutdown and the budget problems that we're having. Our allies and partners there are watching things very closely. For our sake in the Navy, we believe it's that much more important that we make sure they understand that we are dedicated to this, and we're going to keep pursuing it regardless of how hard it may be under the budget uncertainty that we're facing.
It's never a good thing when you walk by the chief of staff's office and you see the JAG, the PAO on the couch waiting to come in to talk to him. And that's one of the roles that a public affairs officer will do
that a lot of people who are used to just seeing the role, whether it's communicating to the press or communicating directly to the taxpayers and people in the military, but there is that role also as an advisor, for lack of a better phrase. If you could please touch on a little bit how public affairs officers function in that role, and what is their official or unofficial charter in that position that they need to perform in order to serve the commander?
That's a great question. As you may know, I was with Admiral Mullen for 11 years. From the time he put on 3 stars and went down to 2nd Fleet till the time he retired in October of 11. And I really got to understand that role of advisor really, really well during those 11 years. There wasn't a meeting that he had that I wasn't able to sit in on, except for a few, you know, flag officer detailing meetings and some special access type of programs that I wasn't read in on. But by and large, there wasn't anything he did during the day that he didn't welcome my attendance. And I took him up on it because being able to sit in the room and listen to him to talk out and to think out loud, to work his way through problems, to interact with the staff, I got to understand the way he thought. And that was the most critical thing in terms of being a good advisor to him and to the media, because I knew where his head was on issues, and I was able to describe to the public and to the media what he thought about it. And it could be as complicated as our relationship with Pakistan or the policy on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There were very few times when a reporter would ask me, well, what does Mullen think about this, that I had to go to him and ask him, because I knew. And that also helped me help him with decisions, because I knew how he thought through problems. I knew what he focused on and what parts of issues he tended not to focus on, and it allowed me the freedom and the flexibility, because I had so much time with him, to get in there and have discussions with him. And Admiral Mullen, and I was very lucky in this regard, was the kind of leader who valued dissenting opinions, who wanted people around him to disagree with him when they believed it, and to do so openly, publicly, and not publicly, but openly in the room anyway, you know, to let him know what you think, the moment that you think it. So I was sort of raised from the time I was a lieutenant commander to sort of think like that. And I think that's what makes a good PAO a great PAO, is the ability to not be intimidated by rank, to know your boss, their strengths and their weaknesses, inside and out, and be willing to have very frank, candid conversations with your boss the moment when the instinct strikes you. Because sometimes if you wait in this world, you wait a little too long to give your boss advice, it may be too late. And I really believe that the PAO and the JAGS in particular, we have a special obligation because of our roles and the information that we're privy to protect the institution by giving the boss good advice. And that's and I know I'm rambling here, but I want to make this one other point. Our loyalties as PAOs need to be to the institution, not to the principal. Admiral Mullen would never stand for me to make his personal reputation my job. That was never what he wanted. He wanted me to protect the institution and the institution's credibility. And if that meant admitting mistakes or being open about things that weren't going well, or even open about things that maybe he didn't decide very well, then that's what he wanted me to do. It was never about the person. It was always about the institution. And I think we have to raise the young PAOs to think like that, that the institution comes first. Your boss is a distant second, if that.
Well, speaking of institutional issues, one of the questions from our chat room is, where do you see a healthy naval discussion these days? What publications, websites, podcasts, journals, things like that, where is that the voice of the fleet being heard, or should the voice of the fleet be heard?
I think this is a great forum. This is why this is my second time with you guys, and I want to keep it up. I think this is a terrific forum. I think Sal does a great job as well in the blogosphere. Information dissemination, I think, is a good one. And frankly, I like what I'm seeing out of proceedings. I had a chance 2 weeks ago to go to the staff at the U.S. Naval Institute to talk about the changes they're making, the things that they're doing. They've got a USNI news service now. They got a pretty healthy blog, and Proceedings remains a forum for debate and discussion of issues of real importance to the Navy, and they take that very seriously, and as do I. I also am proud of our blog, our Navy Live blog. It's very active. A lot of flag officers use it to put things out. We have the opportunity to break a little bit of news and start a little bit of discussion there, so I'm proud of what we're doing. But I hand it to the whole blogosphere in general, because I think particularly those who follow Navy issues, they do it responsibly and well, and I think this is, to borrow a phrase from former Undersecretary Bob Work, we really are heading into a new maritime era. And you don't have to look any further than this defense strategic guidance, this new defense strategy that we're trying to execute, to see that the future is really about the Navy and the Marine Corps, the maritime services. And I would throw the Coast Guard in there as well. It really is a maritime era. And so the more forums for discussion like this and like the other ones I mentioned, the better, because there's real issues that we've got to debate, real serious concerns that everybody has. There are things that are going well, things that are not going well, and I think the more open and the more accessible we all are to one another, the better we'll be as we launch into this new era.
And inside the national boundaries, at least, one of the things about this era that I know has been a challenge really for everybody in uniform, but I think especially those that have to interact with the press a lot, the sequester we've been going through and the ongoing budget battles, that whole evolution, it's very real in the fleet when you're talking about being able to get the proper maintenance, operations, and training, and just, you know, flying from one city to another. But the whole process itself is extremely political, and as such, for being in uniform, it's a very, very tender area that really requires some close thoughts on how you answer questions, how you react. Just personally, I thought when the sequester went out, there was a few things that were put out that I thought were a little bit off key, but you know, you learn as you go through on how you react inside of an extended political environment. What do you think are some of the lessons that we've learned since the sequester and now the budget battle is going on to be able to communicate how it's impacting the fleet, doing that while also maintaining a respectful distance from something that could be considered to be backing up one political side or the other?
Yeah, it's a constant issue for those of us in uniform to stay apolitical, and it's really important that we do. And I know that there were lots of debate and discussion about the degree to which back in the wintertime, when all of this conversation got very public and very animated, whether or not some of us in the military and some of us in the Navy made decisions or talked about decisions in such a way that it looked as if we were trying to get into the political debate perhaps a little bit ahead of ourselves. I can tell you there was certainly no intent to do that. I can understand where the criticism comes from, but there was certainly no intent to do that. And so I think one of the things that we've taken away from that is that we need to make sure that as we talk about the impacts of sequestration and yet another continuing resolution, which is right now we hope we get a CR. It's kind of strange to say that, right? I mean, that you actually are looking, you look forward to a CR right now as we're still in shutdown. But as we talk about these things, we do so based simply on the facts, what we know, and that we admit what we don't know, and that we do it in a very calm and measured and deliberate manner. Now, I'm not saying we didn't do that before, but I can definitely understand where some of the criticism came from folks that thought perhaps there was some breathlessness to the things that we were saying. Again, I wouldn't go so far as to say that was done with malice aforethought, but I do understand where the criticism comes from. We just need to be we need to be honest and forthright about the impacts, what they are, what they aren't, what we anticipate them being, and to try to be as direct as we can. One of the things I don't want to happen is I don't want us to shy away. I mean, for fear of entering into a political debate, I don't want us to shy away from our responsibilities to the American people of explaining to them what their Navy can and can't do under sequestration, because there are some very real things that are going to affect them over time, and I think it's important that we make sure they understand that. Again, without being shrill or hyperbolic or political, but just so that they understand that.
To go along with, I guess, with the forums that you've described as places of for the good discussion about the Navy, are there situations in which I'm going to be careful in phrasing this, active duty naval officers are, to your knowledge, discouraged from some discussions in those forums or in other public debates?
No, I'm not aware of any forums or debates that were discouraging naval officers to participate in. I think, these are real weighty issues. And as I said earlier, there are lots of vehicles for naval officers to debate and discuss, and we want them to. I mean, the CNO has been very clear about desiring the naval officers, but the flag community in general, to speak and to write and to discuss and to be honest, as much as the dictates of operational security and policy will allow. And I think that's the only thing that I would offer as a caution is, you know, once a policy has been set, you know, whether it's been legislated or not, if it's the policy, then that's the policy. And of course, we want people to support the policies that we have to execute. Our job is to execute policy, not to debate it. But inside the execution and the how we're going to do things, I think those are all fair game. We should talk about that. We don't put out, specific guidance to officers about what to write about and what not to write about. I think naval officers are very, very mature individuals. They understand where the lines are and you know how far they can go on a given issue. I think the biggest thing, going back to your last question, which was a great question, is about the apolitical nature of the institution. And I think it's just important for everybody to understand that. While executing policy is our purview, and debating the execution of policy is certainly within the rights of all of us to discuss, the policy itself or the politics behind those policies are beyond our reach and not for us to get into in terms of public discussion.
You brought up the Naval Institute earlier on in the hour. And I want to touch on that a bit. I've been reading Proceedings, member of the Naval Institute, since a kind person was good enough to get me a free subscription as a midshipman. And there seems to be two opposite pressures going on, or not pressures, but two things operating in the same environment, is there's an ongoing drive to try to get junior officers and enlisted personnel to write more, to engage more in the conversation, come out of the shadows, put their ideas out there in the marketplace of ideas and compete. But an institute such as Proceedings, which you could say is kind of the flagship of the Naval Institute's publications arm in some ways, there have been a lot of flag officers who have written articles recently in there under a variety of topics, and it almost as if the flag officer community is sucking some of the oxygen out of the air, such that a junior officer or a really sharp enlisted person just might feel like, well, this isn't the right venue for me. Do we have a good balance on how the flag officers are writing and publicizing in kind of a zero-sum game environment? And do you think that might have an impact on whether junior personnel would go to that venue, or are they going to go over to some online venue simply because they no longer think that's their home?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I hadn't really noticed that in Proceedings. I hope that's not happening, that that junior officers and enlisted are being discouraged to get published because they believe there's the flag officers are taking the oxygen out of it, the way you put it. I know that's not I talked to Admiral Daley, Admiral Daley, of course, president of USNI. I talked to him again just a couple weeks ago when I was in Annapolis, and I can tell you that he is very dedicated to making sure that there is a wide variety of voices in proceedings. In fact, he specifically, when they were briefing me, talked about the outreach to junior officers and the desire to have more junior officers published in the magazine. In fact, they were, I believe, I could be wrong here, but I believe they were getting ready to put their issue together with the junior officer essay writing contest. Some of the results. And publishing those essays. I mean, they're working very hard at outreach at USNI, and I hope they're successful, because I would hate to see that a future such as you described as the one we end up facing. I mean, I think it's important for people to write at all levels in the Navy. It's interesting that you bring this up. I was in a used bookstore about a month ago, and I bought. It's all beat up, and I mean it's very fragile. But it was a collection of essays from proceedings that were published together in 1946. But the essays range all the way from the late 1800s all the way to the 1940s, and you got Lieutenant Chester Nimitz writing in there, you know, and Lieutenant Commander Ernie King writing in there, you know, and King wrote at almost every rank in the Navy. And then, you know, you got guys like Admiral Stavridis, who we all know very well, who's been, you know, published in proceedings. He's written pretty much at every rank he's ever served. He's been published. And I think that's really important. And I hope that people see proceedings as a vehicle for that, because it's really, as you put it, the flagship vehicle for us to debate and discuss real ideas, real issues of interest. And when you go back and you look at this old book and you see the things that they wrote about, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, as simple as how to stand proper watches to a two ocean strategy, all written by people of all ranks. Some of them went places in the Navy and some of them never did. But I think it's important that at every level, those voices get heard at every level of rank and at every level of issue, because that's the only way you can move the Navy forward. So I know I'm rambling here, but I do hope that I hope that the oxygen isn't being sucked out by the senior ranks, because that would be a real shame. I think an institution can only claim itself as a learning institution, a learning organization, if at every level people feel comfortable contributing to the debate of ideas.
Well, this is a slightly different topic, but when a movie like Captain Phillips is being set up, and the Navy obviously was heavily involved in the actual Maersk Alabama event, how much participation from your shop goes into working with a filmmaker on a movie like that?
Well, a lot, in this particular case, a lot of support, and I can't take any credit for that. I mean, that really happened before my watch under Admiral Denny Moynihan, who was the CHINFO before me. But the Navy contributed quite a bit to the movie. Now, it's as you know, when we assist the entertainment industry, it is at no additional cost to the Navy. So for the filming that they did at sea and aboard ships, I mean, these were vessels and units that were already exercising or operating, and we brought the camera crews out there. You know, we're limited, and we can't do anything, you know, specifically for. But there was a lot of effort provided for this particular movie. And if you haven't seen it, I highly encourage you to go see it. It's a terrific movie. Tom Hanks does a great job playing the role of Captain Phillips. And frankly, I think the Navy does. The Navy as a character in the movie is represented quite well, you know, because I remember when the operation went down, I was on the joint staff as Admiral Mullen's PIO in April of 2009 when this happened. And as I watched the movie, it brought back all the memories of the incidents and the timeline and how things happened, you know, when he tried to escape by jumping overboard and all that stuff. It just came right back, and I remembered it. But I also remembered how much the Navy as a team came to his rescue. It's easy to get fixated in the Captain Phillips story by thinking about the Navy SEALs and those incredibly brilliant shots they took that killed those pirates. Just absolutely amazing. But what the movie does, I think, is it shows you how the whole Navy really got involved in this. It wasn't just about the SEALs. It was about the destroyers and the amphib and the helicopter pilots and the corpsmen aboard the ship that they brought Captain Phillips back. All that, it was a real team effort. So the Navy itself is a great character in this movie. But yes, we did contribute to it. We have a whole office in Los Angeles that liaises with the entertainment industry and helps us out with shows like NCIS, which we continue to advise. It's just been a terrific success, and all the way up to movies like Captain Phillips and, of course, you know, Battleship that came out last year.
It had to have been maybe a month or 6 weeks ago. I saw it when I was channel surfing. It prompted me to say, the next time I talk to you, I wanted to bring this up. But you were being interviewed, and the person interviewing got under your, not so much got under your skin, but for lack of a better phrase, you got a little energetic and pushed back a bit, which I think, I mean, you did it very respectfully and nice and everything. You could tell the backs of your ears were getting a little red, and I liked that, and here's why. There's a lot of things, especially not directly related to military affairs, but do involve military personnel, that have come up in the last few years where people are using studies that have questionable statistics or trying to take the specific and apply it to a general, and when a member of the press gets hold of bad information or something that helps them feel like they can get a story out of it, they bring it up to somebody's attention, and we don't push back on it. We demur, go to a different topic, or just nod our heads and say we're concerned, we're looking forward to, buying into the premise that when you actually look at the documents, that it's almost insulting to say that all sailors, just I'll use two examples, that all sailors are rapists, and
right,
Everybody that has PTSD wants to blow their brains out. And I know that there's been a habit to avoid confrontation, and confrontation is too strong of a word, but there is something, I think, respectful and really required, because ultimately it's defending the honor of our sailors, to push back sometimes when people are using bad information or are basically trying to put forward negative ideas but through silence and nodding heads, we just accept it, and they develop a life. One particular study involving sexual assault has developed a life of its own when it's already been debunked out in the press, but because nobody ever pushed back on it and appropriately addressed it. As a community, as public affairs, have you looked at and talked with PAOs, when's the appropriate time to stiffen your spine a bit and find a way to at least stop somebody who's pushing something, as opposed to redirecting or accepting their premise?
Yeah, it's a great, great question, and I thank you for it. You very articulate the way you've described the problem, and the answer is the right time is now, immediately. When there is bad information out there, you've got to act immediately to correct it, because a false narrative allowed to survive within the hour becomes the narrative. It is very difficult to change that narrative if you aren't beating it back immediately. Now, back to when we first started having this conversation, we talked about, you know, you were talking about the operations this weekend and that kind of thing, and I said, you know, you got to find the right balance here. You have to be right when you push back, but if you know you're right and you've got the facts, you have to do it immediately. And then you can't just stop at the one. You've got to, I don't want to say overdo it, but you have to look for other opportunities beyond the reporter or the media outlet that may be getting it wrong to make sure that you have corrected that record, and you have to do it over and over again. And I talk about this with PAOs everywhere I go, all the all-hands calls that I do. There's no time like now to fix a bad story, because you're never going to have another chance, or you may not have another chance. So you've got to get out there. And, yes, I want to be respectful. I mean, I believe that reporters and bloggers and those that write and speak about the Navy do so with the best of intentions. My dad used to say, nobody comes to work wanting to do a bad job. Everybody wants to do a good job. But, you know, people make mistakes, or they form opinions that maybe aren't complete. And so I never want to be rude or disrespectful about it. But I always want to make sure that that I have that ability to get into that discussion early and to try to correct the record where I can. It's just as important when the criticism is valid and accurate that we own up to that. That, you know, it can't just always be about pushback. There's a I don't want to raise a generation of young PAOs to think that their whole job is simply to rebut. We rebut when necessary, but also when necessary, we admit. And that is, we admit our shortcomings, we admit our failures, we admit the mistakes that get made, because the Navy is just like any large institution, and not everybody in it makes the right decisions. Not every decision that we make or every policy we execute, do we execute well. So it's important for our credibility that we likewise are the first to admit when we've made a mistake, the first to state publicly that something went wrong as well. And that's where, for me, it's really all about credibility, and you only get credibility in both cases when you're not just willing to defend, but you're willing to admit when the institution has made a mistake.
Let me go back to the Captain Phillips movie and some thoughts or some questions I have. When we won't generally discuss, say, a special operations tactics and procedures, for a variety of reasons, but there's a movie that's based on, to a certain extent, those practices and procedures. Who vets that? Who has a chop on how much information is allowed to be revealed, or are they,
right.
Or does anyone have that ability?
Yeah, sure.
To
absolutely. Yeah, that's a great. No, it's a good question. I do, and I flew out to Los Angeles almost a year ago to look at the first cut of the movie. For that very purpose, to view it for accuracy and content, and also a guy named Phil Strube, who really has he's really the one that has the final say. So he's a legend in the Pentagon. He's been working entertainment on behalf of OSD for many, many years, and he also gets a cut on everything we do with the entertainment industry to make sure that it accurately and fairly portrays the military, and that it doesn't give away the things whether it's a TV show or a movie, that doesn't give away operational security. So this movie was viewed with a very close eye on that. I can tell you, having again been on the joint staff in April 2009 when this rescue happened, and watching the movie myself, it is very accurate, but it is not. It doesn't give away things that we wouldn't want out there. I mean, it's accurate. It's not necessarily 100% complete, nor would we want it to be. But I think it'll give the viewer a very good idea of, again, how the teamwork and how the Navy came to the rescue of Captain Phillips. But, yes, there's a process for this. We are involved. The services are involved, as is OSD. There's many layers of review and approval of scripts, of costumes, and of plot, even of character to some degree, depending on the actual form of entertainment we're talking about. It's very, very it's very well thought out, and I think it's important, quite frankly, not just to make sure that the entertainment industry gets things right, but that we embrace the entertainment industry as another vehicle to continue to inform the American people about what their military can do.
Well, we do have one inaccuracy that our regular Maggie, who is from Boston, was not very impressed with Mr. Hank's Boston accent. He said, according to him, he could have used a little more work on the by and the yon and everything else. But I'm just a Southerner. It all sounds equally horrible to me. But the kind of flipping to a different topic here is. People, just like when we had our first conversation earlier this year, you know, you described how you became a PAO, and you kind of, nobody starts from the ground level to PAO. People come in it from different communities. But when somebody transitions over to be a PAO, you know, what kind of initial job responsibility are they given? Or do they ever go to a command alone and unafraid for the first assignment? Are they with another PAO? How does that initial transition tour take place for a new PAO?
It's another great question. We watch that very carefully. Most PAOs, as we talked about last time, come into through the lateral transfer process. So they're normally at the lieutenants. They've been in the Navy for a few years. Most of them have warfare designations, although not all, but they've got some experience behind them, and they lateral transfer into our community. The first thing that we do when we bring them in, and we get between 5 and 15 lateral transfers a year, depending on my quotas, the first thing that we do is we send them to Defense Information School up there at Fort Meade, which is a terrific institution. They get a very, very good basic education in public affairs from a Defense Department perspective. I make it a point to speak to every single class that goes through there. I talk to all of the students from all the services, but I also make it a special point to get up there and talk to my Navy students. I just did this about less than a month ago to talk to them about Navy public affairs, because we do things a little differently in the Navy than the other services. So they get, when they first get into our community, they hear directly from me within weeks of getting accepted or getting into the school, and then we make sure that they do well at the school. We watch them. When they leave school, It is my priority to get them as brand new PAOs to a staff or a organization that does two things. One, gets them close to the waterfront. I want them to understand public affairs at the waterfront level as quickly as possible. Number two, to be surrounded by senior PAOs. So one of the places I send a lot of brand new PAOs is to our NPACES, the Navy Public Affairs Support Elements. The command is headquartered in Norfolk, headed by an 06, but they have a detachment in San Diego, and we have other smaller detachments around the fleet as well, around the world. But these are great places for young PAOs to go because they're surrounded by mass communication specialists, our enlisted talent, as well as senior PAOs who can wrap their arms around them and kind of show them the ropes. And it's very operational. We send NPACE elements out to every CSG and ARG that deploys, so they'll get time at sea. They'll get time to lead young sailors out there and to really kind of see public affairs from a grassroots level. With the protection and the wisdom and the leadership of senior PAOs, I also send a few of them to CHINFO, this new graduating class that's coming out of DINFOS very soon. About two or three of them are going to come to CHINFO. That's a great place for them to go as well, because they're going to get to see they'll see it from DC, not the fleet level, but they'll get to see how public affairs is done at that level with, again, plenty of supervisory wisdom and leadership over them. But it's real important for me. Their first tour matters a lot to me, and I watch it closely because I want them getting their hands dirty. I want them to get quoted. I want them to deal with reporters and bloggers, but I want them to also have some leadership over them so that, that they don't feel like they're just off on their own. I very rarely will send a brand new PAO to an independent duty somewhere where they're just they're the only PAO for 100 miles reporting right to a an 06 or an 07. I just don't want to do that. They need time to kind of get acclimated. But I'll tell you something else, and you didn't ask this, but I'm going to take the moment to talk about it. The talent that we're getting in the community is amazing, and I'm not just talking about the officers. I'm talking about the enlisted. The young people that are drawn to the public affairs community these days, I could never have competed with them when I came in. I came into this community a bit of a lark. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do in the Navy, and I could not compete with them the way they are today. They're smarter, they're more mature, they're more educated, they're more driven, they are much more comfortable in this social media environment than I am even now, certainly than I ever would have been. They're just incredible. When I go up to DINFOS, I don't just talk to our public affairs officers. I talked to our A school. Our A school for our enlisted sailors is there at DINFOS as well. It's world-class, absolutely world-class training. They're working with equipment and technology that is cutting edge up there. And these sailors, and they tend to be our MCs. They tend to be older than the average sailor. Usually their average age of about 25, 26. Most of them have either a college degree or college time. And almost half of them have some sort of prior civilian experience in public relations, in blogging, in journalism. They've been around the block. They know what this environment is, and they're just at ease with it. They're comfortable in it in ways that I never would have expected them to be. So I really, when I look out at the future of our community, it's quite bright, and I'm very, very excited about it.
Let me ask a question about the information flow. It's a few weeks ago we had a helicopter accident in the Red Sea. From your perspective, as you're sitting on top of the information food chain, how frustrating is it, or what's it like? How do you get the information flow from a ship reporting an incident like that all the way up to you, where somebody has to respond and let the world know what's going on out there?
I haven't been frustrated. It's been very, very good. I mean, in that particular case, the fleet PAO, who is just a stellar PAO, kept me informed right from the get-go, and I knew what was happening. Sometimes I had information with respect to that particular mishap before the even some of the operational reporting, the message traffic moved its way up the chain of command because we had such a great great public affairs office out there in the Fifth Fleet. So I felt very comfortable with the information flow and what I was getting. I'll be honest with you, though. There are other times when information flow could be better. I'm not going to deny that. And it does get frustrating at times when I can't seem to get what I want as fast as I want it. And it's not, I don't want the information so that I can just immediately get it out. Some of it's stuff you don't want out there. But you want to know what's really happening or what we think is really happening so that you don't steer a reporter in the wrong direction. Because oftentimes a reporter will call and they'll have threads of information and they'll want to confirm it. And if you know what really happened, you can at least help a reporter from getting it wrong. So there are times when it gets frustrating. In this particular case, I wasn't frustrated at all because the Fifth Fleet Public Affairs Officer Office did such a great job keeping us informed. And to the degree that I can, particularly when it's a mishap like that, and our thoughts and prayers continue to go out to the families of those two who were killed, you want the information to flow from and to be confirmed from the fleet. And not from CHINFO. To the degree possible, you want to decentralize the information flow. It's the right thing to do for the media and for those who cover these things, but it's also the right thing to do for the fleet because they're the ones that have the best access to information, and not every story should be led from CHINFO or Washington, D.C.
Especially at conferences, whether you're looking at speaking of the Naval Institute, like Naval Institute West or Joint Warfighting Seminar, you'll have a lot of the PAOs wandering around, usually in trail with one of their flag officers that they're trying to keep out of trouble. But there's also a lot of press there. And you know, I've had some great conversations with some PAOs over the years, both in and out in the town. And there is, when you communicate, there is building personal relationships between PAOs and the press. Beyond, it's not a pure personal relationship, but it's more than just professional. You
right.
get to know them personally. What are some of the advice that you give to PAOs to be able to respect the importance of building personal relationships with people in the press, but also being aware that you're making friends with a pet wolf, so to speak? You can't really completely and utterly trust it because of its nature. How do you try to train PAOs to get that balance going so that you have a pretty good conduit of information both ways, but it doesn't slip into something that could compromise what really is their job?
Yeah, I actually wrote about this not long ago. I send out emails to the entire public affairs community at times, and the last one I wrote, I called it "Take a Hike." And the reason I said that was I want public affairs officers to get up off their butts every now and then and walk around and get to know reporters for who they are, not just for what they write about or what they report about. Get to know them as people. And the only way you can do that is to get up out of your desk, off the phone, off of email, and build these relationships. The worst time to try to establish trust with a reporter, a relationship, is in the middle of a crisis. You have already established that, and that can only be done human to human. And they're people, just like you and me. They believe in what they do. They do perform a public service. They're as dedicated and as competitive as we are in the military. You know, anybody that's served knows that, you know, we're all type A's. We all want to be the best at what we do, and they're no different. It's just that they have a different mission than we do, and it's important for us to understand that. It is also important for us to understand them as people. And so my advice to PAOs, and I put this in writing, and I'll be happy to send it to you if you guys want to see it, was, you know, get to know them personally. Where'd they grow up? Where'd they go to college? How many kids do they have? What's the name of their dog? I mean, find out who they are. Not so that you can form an unhealthy personal friendship. You're right in your question. You don't want to do that. And they don't want that either. They don't want to be seen as too close to the military or to any of their sources. But you do need to know them, know their strengths, know their weaknesses, know the perspective with which they come at a question or a problem, because that's the only way you're going to be able to provide them the context they need. And context, that's the coin of the realm. That's what they need, and that's what we as PAOs should be providing them. Our job is not to provide information. That's a piece of it. Our job is to provide context, to help reporters understand the why behind an issue, not just what we're doing, but why we're doing it that way. And you can't even begin to endeavor to have that kind of a conversation with a reporter if you haven't built a relationship based on trust and familiarity. Not undue familiarity, but familiarity. So I think it's critical. And my advice to the community, and again, I've made this very, very clear, and I put it in writing, is you gotta start to build those relationships before you even think you need them, because when you do need them, if you haven't built that trust, it's too late. It's too late. You're already behind the power curve, and it'll be that much harder for you to get your side of the story out.
Well, we're down to under a minute, Admiral. I want to thank you for coming on today, and I especially apologize for the technical difficulties, which kind of made the start of the show a little rough. I appreciate your patience with us. One of the aspects of your job is to get good news out about the Navy. Isn't it harder to get good news out than to respond to the various bad news stories that seem to pop up?
It can be. It depends on the good news, right? I mean, a lot of things that we think is good, we think is, you know, great news. Other people, it's hard to sell it because it's not as dynamic or it's not as confrontational or controversial. But it is so. Yes, it is a challenge at times. But if you find that good story, if you find that hook, and it's tied, and you can make it. And you can make it make sense to reporters, you can get it out there. You just have to work a little bit harder at it. It just takes a little bit more of a sense. And again, this is where those relationships come in, because you can pull on some of those relationships with reporters to say, okay, here's something that maybe you weren't thinking about that might be worth covering. And so, you know, we have a pretty good success rate. I wouldn't say we win on everyone. There are some things we can't get people interested in, but you got to keep trying because there are great sailors out there doing great things every single day. And while we have plenty of vehicles inside the lifelines, you know, Navy.mil and all kinds of other vehicles at our disposal, there's nothing like seeing, you know, getting it on the network news or getting it on CNN or getting it in the New York Times. It just takes a little bit of extra work.
And that about wraps us up. I wanted to thank you very much again, Admiral Kirby, for coming on this afternoon. It's been a great hour.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks very much, guys. Can't wait to do it again.
Great.
Yes, sir.
And,
thank you.
That's been our guest for today, the Navy Chief of Information, Rear Admiral John Kirby. We'll encourage everybody to join us again next week for another live edition of MidWraps, where we're going to have as our guest Lieutenant Matt Hipple. He is the XO of USS Monsoon. We're going to discuss some of his thoughts on C-SWAP, but more importantly, touch into some of the finer aspects of small unit leadership. And just as a personal note, those who have been following me for a while know that one of my favorite ships and ship stories and stories about leadership is from the First World War, the German light cruiser Emden, and the Australian Navy. Celebrating 100 years since their first warship came into port. Great ally for us. I think they also did a very class act because the first battle fought by the Australian Navy as the Australian Navy was the Battle of the Cocos in 1913 against the SMS Emden. It's a great story if you haven't read The Swan of the East or The Last Gentleman at War. I would encourage you both to look those up for the story of the Emden. It's also a good story about how former adversaries can comport themselves with class. So thank you very much, everybody. I hope you have a great Navy Day, and we will see you in a week. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.